we can make this even better than what we have right now. So we have radio program, we have FightingBob.com and our blogs every day, and we've got at least BobFest North. We could have more BobFest if we want to, or we could split it up even more by including Iowa and Minnesota and other states. All of this, it just says to me that we are now in an interesting spot. We've established ourselves. 11 years. Who would have thought that we would have 11 straight years of fighting BobFest without going broke? Anybody knows how I keep books would really have to question how we've stayed alive during this time. And I think you could say that Betty Garvey is the reason that we still can stand here with our clothes on, having paid for some of them. But we really have to ask ourselves, all right, what do we do from here? Where do we go? What do we do? Hightower is saying, let's get Phil Donahue and get the people saying, use all your contacts. Let's take this thing on the road, because it was Jim Hightower's idea in the first instance to have what he called the Rolling Thunder Chautauquas all over the country. And we were the first ones to do it, and now we're the model for Iowa and Vermont and Illinois and other states who are at least thinking about it. Should we take that on, or should we just stay with the group that we have here in the state of Wisconsin? Take it to the road. Well, as we're talking in these breakout sessions, let's discuss what to do and how to do it. And I think that, you know, it's one thing I've found about organizations over the years is there's always a time when there should be a change of personnel. And I think I'd like to suggest to you that this is my last BobFest in terms of being a chair. I hope I can perform in some other ways, whether it's taking BobFest on the road or helping those who come after. But at some point, one has to face the realities of life, and I think I'm facing that one right now. So I'm looking forward to what we're going to be doing today, because I've never seen a better group of speakers. I don't think it's ever happened before. So as you get ready for that and the breakout sessions this afternoon, let's always be thinking, what is our plan for the next year, and the next year, and the next year? Is it to go on the road, as someone just over there hollered, or is it to stay here? Is it to involve more people in the process? Is it to form a corporation, a membership organization, so that instead of just coming in and giving your contributions, you'd actually be a voting member of the nonprofit? I mean, there are all sorts of different ways to approach what we're doing. But the main thing, we don't want to get stuck in the past or stuck in what we're doing. We have all sorts of good ideas to be exposed. And as we go through those sessions this afternoon, I think you'll hear even more ideas. But so don't expect to get all the answers from up here, because you know Zweifel, he doesn't have that many. And you know me, and I don't have any. So we need to get those ideas coming from you, and let the people who are running this show take it from there. So welcome to everybody who is here. We're a 501c3. It means we're nonpartisan. That's why we've invited socialists and libertarians and Republicans and everybody else to come here. If you see a Republican, would you please hold up a yellow flag? We'll have to have somebody accompany him. Well, give him a free beer. Everyone here doing great. License number 666-KHA. It's a blue Electra. Your car is going to be towed, or is going to be towed unless you move your car. So if you have a 666-KHA, is 666, is that the devil? The devil has arrived. 666, show yourself. Why, it's Scott Walker. So anyway, if you would, move your car. I have the privilege of introducing someone who has been here for... How many BobFests have you been to? You can't count them all. She's bad mathematics. Ruth Conniff is a friend of Fighting BobFest. She's a great political writer. She is with the Progressive Magazine, and she is going to co-chair the event this year with me. And I'm delighted to welcome Ruth to make some opening remarks. Please welcome Ruth Conniff of the Progressive Magazine, who's going to help us with FightingBob.com.
Good morning, progressives. It is great to be here this morning. What a great night last night. I am really honored to be able to co-chair this with Ed Garvey, who is a hero of mine and all of ours in the progressive movement in Wisconsin. I wanted to give you a little bit of news flash from the Progressive Magazine, which just goes to what Ed was talking about, that we are winning. This is a long fight, but it is a fight that we're on the right side of, and it's one of the main reasons that we're here today. Of course, you all know what happened on Friday with the circuit court stopping Act 10. This is something that Scott Walker is having to think about a lot this weekend. It's kind of a tough couple of days for him. He's thinking it through. He's planning his strategy. But I want to tell you a little bit of news you may not have had about one of the particularly difficult aspects of this for Governor Walker. Late Thursday afternoon, after the office was closed, I got a call on my cell phone from somebody who works in the Secretary of State's office for Doug LaFollette, namesake of Fighting Bottom. And this person just couldn't help herself. She had to call us to tell us that she had just received an executive order from the governor. And she said, I have to tell somebody, do you have a fax machine? There's only a print copy. There's no electronic copy yet. The governor has declared Monday, September 17th, Read the Constitution Day. So in light of what happened on Friday, I think we're going to be looking at a repeal of that order by Monday. This is bad timing for Scott Walker. But right, I called Matt right away. He got something up on our website. It was just too good to miss. So, I think we should take the governor up, by the way, on this, and I think we should publicize this order as widely as we can, because on Monday I think we should all be out there with copies of our Constitution on the Capitol lawn. Ed Garvey asked me to just give you a couple of remarks about what Fighting Bob Fest really means to me, to the Progressive Magazine, to the Progressive Movement in Wisconsin. So I've been thinking about this. What does Fighting Bob Fest mean? And I think as Ed throws it out to all of us to think about where are we going from here, this is really part of what Bob Fest is all about. I will tell you, when you talk about taking this on the road and connecting nationally with the progressive movement across this country, I think there is really something to be said for that. And I will just share with you one experience I had when I was in Tampa at the Republican Convention. One of the greatest things that I saw there was the Citizens Organization in Florida were fighting Governor Rick Scott, very similar to the battle against Scott Walker. The statewide organization that they have created there, Awake the State. I went to a meeting of a subset of that group in Pinellas County called Awake Pinellas. And there, in the shadow of the Republican Convention, in the Rick Scott regime, they have created a citizens' movement on the local level to change policy and affect progressive change. And it is really happening. In St. Petersburg, Florida, they are packing city council meetings, and they are giving their handful of progressive council members cover to roll back the austerity regime in their city. So there are no more austerity measures on the table. And in fact, what they have now instead is a debate over which taxes to raise to continue to support their public schools and their public, all of their public goods in that town. It can be done. It can be done. We can do it on a grassroots level, on a local level. And as we all know here in Wisconsin, this stuff hits home. This is not pie in the sky philosophical stuff. This is whether our children are going to have art teachers anymore. You know, this is whether we are going to have civil society and a middle class as we have known it. And we are down temporarily sometimes in this cycle, but we are not out, and we are going to win because we are right. So this is my list. Why Fighting Bob Fest now? Because we need progressive voices and values now more than ever. Because we have to remember that what we are fighting for are the same values we've been fighting for since Bob LaFollette declared war on the money power on behalf of the people. Because in this historic year, it's important to remember that we're still here, we're still right, and the historic energy of the Wisconsin uprising is still available to us whenever we decide to get together and unleash it. Because the other side is so transparently bad. That convention in Tampa What they are selling in the way of austerity for most of us, the destruction of civil society and tax breaks for the very rich, is just a dog. And people recognize it. All these billionaires getting together and funding this campaign, the most expensive presidential campaign in history, getting behind their candidate, all the money power in our entire country. And who do they have? What are they selling us? Mitt Romney. It's what they got. This can be beat. Furthermore, why now? Because our side only wins when it embraces real majoritarian progressive values, and just look at that Democratic convention. Bill Clinton may have given us NAFTA. He may have signed the repeal of Glass-Steagall, but his speech at the convention hit it out of the park, defending unions, American manufacturing, taxing and regulating Wall Street, not to mention almost every speaker who got up on that platform defending same-sex marriage, women's rights, and public systems of health care and education. These are our values, and they are the values that the Democratic Party needs in order to win. It's not that we need the Democrats to champion our values. The reality, the Democrats need us, and more importantly, our country needs us, and that's why we're here. Welcome, and thanks for being here.
Unless Peter Leidy comes out here, I'm going to have to give a speech. Please welcome, are you ready? Please welcome Peter Leidy, everyone's favorite. He keeps us laughing and he keeps us in tune, so please welcome Peter. Here you are.
Thank you, Ed.
No red tennis shoes allowed. Governor Walker just issued a decree.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for inviting me back, Ed. This is inspired by a John Denver song and my love for the state of Wisconsin in all its quirkiness. You fill up my senses like a night in Waupaca, like Sheboygan in springtime, like the Kettle Moraine, Saturdays on the Flambeau, and Sundays at Lambeau. You fill up my senses, come fill me again. The birthplace of progressives and the hamburger, public sector unions, guitarist Les Paul, and now in our capital, just to keep it a safe place, 482 panic buttons have just been installed. You fill up my senses like a drive-through Kenosha, like the orchards in Gay's Mills, like a dairy in Dane, like the deep-fried aroma at a truck stop near Toma. You fill up my senses, come fill me again. Thank you. Love song for Wisconsin. And this song, inspired by hundreds of thousands of people, some of whom are right here. And some of you can partially sort of help sing along with this. Even if you don't know the words, you could actually sing anything while I'm singing this song, and it would make this thing a whole lot better. Really would. The legend lives on from Superior on down of the great state we call Wisconsin. 'Twas the year 2010 when disaster set in,
and Russ Feingold lost to Ron Johnson. With the help from Koch brothers, there were quite a few others putting working folks over the barrel. With Governor Scott came a dastardly plot and the wreck of the brothers Fitzgerald. Public employees, they serve our state well, but the Gov and the Fitzes don't think so. Giving workers a stab with their big power grab, just one reason that that bill stunk so. Well, the Capitol Dome is the people's home, but democracy soon was in peril. A few with the clout began locking us out. It's the wreck of the brothers Fitzgerald. Does anyone know where the decency goes when you beat up on teachers and nurses and take funding from those who need it the most to fill up the millionaires' purses? Yes, the legend lives on from Superior on down, from Beloit to Viroqua to Merrill. And it's still not too late to save our great state from the wreck of the brothers Fitzgerald.
Thank you. So, it's not too late. It is so not too late. One more little song here. What have we seen at the Capitol just in the last few days? Wowza! Wowza! You can't take pictures there. You can't take pictures.
Yeah.
Singers getting tickets. Officers coming to your house to issue you a citation. Handcuffs. This song is called I Will Cite You Right Now, as sung by Capitol Police Chief David Irwin.
I see you over there holding that sign. You're out of line. This house is mine. And I think to myself, I will cite you right now. No pictures today. Put that camera away. You ain't got a permit. You may not stay. You're terrorizing people. I'm gonna cite you right now. I'll come to your house. I'll knock on your door. And when you ask, hey, what are you here for? I will issue you a ticket so happily. And then you'll understand. Speech is not free. I've made up my mind. Don't give me no lip. I've got the badge and I'm on a power trip. You better stop singing or I'll cite you right now. Yeah, you better stop all that singing and peacefully holding up those signs or I'll cite you right now.
Thank you. Thank you. Wow. Please, save the standing ovation for the grannies. Thanks a lot.
Our next speaker doesn't really need an introduction, but I get to introduce him anyway. He is the president of the Professional Firefighters of Wisconsin, the youngest and the first African-American president of that organization. He's been a firefighter for more than 15 years. As you probably remember, he ran for lieutenant governor, and he is really one of the great voices of the uprising in the great state of Wisconsin. We got to know him well, seeing him leading the marches, showing up with all those bagpipes behind him. So inspiring, such an inspiring speaker, a man with a huge future in Wisconsin politics and beyond, no doubt. Is he here?
Peter Lighting.
Peter Lighting, no. Now we need the bagpipes to come out. Right, we need the empty chair.
He doesn't come.
He's on his way.
He really likes the green.
I know, we need to start the chant. Maylin, 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 Maylin. Maylin. It worked, everybody. Here he comes, Maylin Mitchell.
How we doing? I guess I missed my introduction. I'm sorry, nature called, but how we doing tonight? Today. It's today, isn't it? Why is it so damn dark in here then? All right. Well, I want to start my remarks by, first of all, saying thank you. As many of you know, I ran for lieutenant governor in the recall election. And thank you. But I want to say thank you to all of you, because I know many of you in the audience filled phone banks, canvassed, did lid drops to help out in the recall election. And I want to say thank you to all of you for all your hard work, all your dedication. And we're not over. We're not finished. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But give yourselves a round of applause for all the hard work you've done in the past year. So you all know I ran against Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish. And what you don't know, I know this is a nonpartisan event, so I won't say anything bad about her. But what you don't, oh, I can. I'll tell a story. How about that? Who here has all seen the Mike Goucher show, this Sunday Journal, the political journal that comes on every Sunday? Okay. Lieutenant Governor Clayfish and I had a joint appearance, and it was an hour-long segment. We were there for the full hour. But what you didn't know and what you didn't see was what happened in between the segments. So I'll tell you about what happened between the first and second segment when they were going to their commercial break and they were regrouping. It's obviously taped. So we take a break after the first 15 minutes or so. So after the first 15 minutes of us going back and forth and talking about the issues, we were sitting there and she was talking about her kids. I was talking about mine. We were talking about families. And then I went to take a drink of my water, and she went to take a drink of her coffee. Well, what she didn't realize is that at the beginning of the first segment, she had unscrewed her coffee top. So she went to take a drink of her coffee, and the coffee spilled all the way down her shirt, all the way down her skirt, and all over. And once she realized what happened, she actually flipped up the coffee because she realized what happened, and she flipped up. Then the coffee splashed all over her face, and then it got all over the table, all over my right arm, and all over Mike Goucher. Now, thank God, in all seriousness, that the coffee was not hot, seriously. But being a firefighter, like I am, I wanted to help. So the producer and a couple of the camera people grabbed towels and some napkins and gave her some. And I grabbed a towel as well, and I started to clean up the table in front of her, in front of myself, and help Mike a little bit and help her as well. And she said, "You know what, Maylin? Thank you for helping. I'm so embarrassed that I did this, and you didn't have to help me, but you're being such a good sport. Thank you for helping me, because I'm so embarrassed." I said, "You know what, Lieutenant Governor? That's no problem. This is just another time where the Democrats are cleaning up the Republicans' mess once again." And the people always ask me, "Yes, I really did say that." And no, I think it was taped, but obviously did not air. But my campaign manager was throwing Nick a red gum in his mouth the entire time because he was so nervous that I said that to her. But anyway, in what seems like a lifetime ago, in February 2011, everyday people took to the streets of Wisconsin to speak out, to speak up, make their voices heard. Because we had a surprise attack on our Wisconsin values and the Wisconsin that we know and love. That moment grew into a movement, which brought us to where we are today, a place where we fought back against the money. We fought back against the power and the privilege that sparked a civil war in Wisconsin. What the election results on June 5th showed me that we still have a state that is deeply divided. It showed that this election is not just about a process. It's not just about one election or two, even two elections. It's about a movement. And I don't like to call it a movement. I like to call it a way of life because movement's in. So this has to become a way of life of what we're doing right now. Now, last year I spoke at Fighting Bob Fest, and in all honesty and all seriousness, I never would have thought that I'd be running for political office this year. But what I saw last year, when we took it to the streets, and I saw the amazing people organizing, immobilizing, and educating the state of Wisconsin of what Wisconsin values are truly about, I had no other choice but to run in the recall election. I don't regret it at all. Some say, Malin, you and the Democrats, you and the progressives, well, you had high expectations. Well, I always say, I don't know anybody that can rise to low expectations. So we are supposed to have high expectations, and I still have high expectations. Some say, well, Malin, you and the progressives and the Democrats and your union and labor friends, and I don't mind saying the word union. I'm a proud union member. And I'm a proud union leader. But some say you and your union members, well, you guys came up short. And I say, you know what, I got to tell it like it is, folks, because that's the only way I know how to tell it. Yeah, we came up a little bit short, but we came out strong. And we built a foundation for the future of our progressive values. But now we see what happens when we are all together. When we are all together in unison, one united voice, one united message. Blending labor rights and civil rights and American politics into one action where we all work together. We can never, ever lose that. We have to remember what happened last year. We have to remember what we did in the recall because it wasn't just about the election. It's about what we did. It's about what we did. We cannot forget that. This fight for the middle class has inspired me like nothing else in my life. But there's a couple of things that I did learn and some things that we didn't know that I learned especially right up front or hardcore when it came to Wisconsin, when it came to unions. Right now, unions are being vilified. They call us thugs. They call us union bosses. Whitakers and everybody else, for some reason, are the givers. All the rich, all of a sudden, they're all job creators. The rich and wealthy. I don't mind rich and wealthy people, don't get me wrong. They buy me drinks. But now, all of a sudden, we call them job creators. Back in the 19th century, they called them robber barons. But all of a sudden, unions are the problem, and the Republicans and the rich and the wealthy are the solution. But I like to look in the mirror before I look at someone else. I had one older gentleman tell me up north, and I won't tell you where he was. I think Eau Claire or something. Oh, I'd say I won't tell you where he was. But he said, you want to know what's wrong with unions? Ask a union member. And I thought about that on the ride home. I said, you know what, he's right. We as unions, and I know we're not all in unions here, but I'm a union leader, so I always go back to my roots and talking about labor and what we need to do to change. There's no doubt in my mind that we need to change some things that we are doing. And we got to go back to what I like to call the three C's of unions now. Communities, coalitions, and common sense. What do I mean by that? Well, communities. We got to get back as labor leaders and as union members, as activists, back into our communities. And I'm not just talking about the 501C, the political rhetoric about having a 501C. I'm talking about unions actually being involved in the day-to-day social advocacy that's happening in their communities. We used to do that. Remember that there was a time where unions stood side by side with civil rights. But we don't see that now. That's why we're losing some of the messaging. We're losing some of the battles because unions and civil rights are not combined right now. We got to get back into our communities and do more social advocacy. Coalitions. Right now, all labor is speaking. All labor is at the table, private, public, as well as industrial. We're all at the table speaking the same message. talking about decent hours, wages, and working conditions for the middle class. Well, we should have done that before because we were asleep before. I'll be honest with you. We were stagnant. But no more. And Wisconsin's an uprising, but we should have never been asleep. So we got to build these coalitions and never let them be broken again. And that's coalitions meaning just all of us working together. And common sense. What do I mean by common sense? Well, when I ran, I was told a lot of things to say. I was told a lot of things I shouldn't say. And I take some of it, I threw some of it away. But at the end of the day, I'm going to say what I want to say because we got to talk about common sense. And common sense means we got to talk to everybody. And I'm talking about now as a Democratic Party. We have to have common sense in our messaging because right now the far right is killing us with saying less taxes. Well, everybody likes less taxes. Whether you're rich or poor, you want to pay less taxes. They talk about freedom. But we all know that's a misnomer. They talk about freedom and being out of your lives. But they want to tell you what you can do in your bedroom. And they want to tell you as a woman what kind of rights you have. But they talk about freedom. So we know it's a lie. But it's winning right now. And they talk about lowering taxes, less, more freedom. I want to say, there was a study. And I don't want to go over my time here. But there was a study done. And there were three people in line. They gave the first, in a shopping line, they gave the first person $3, the second person $2, and the last person $1. They said, now you in the middle with $2, you got to give a dollar to someone, either the person in front of you or the person behind you. Well, you know that 78% of the people in that line gave that $1 to the person in front of them that had $3. Now, when asked the question, why would you give the dollar to the person that had more money than you? Well, all of them said, well, I didn't want the person behind me to have more money than I have. So that's what we're dealing with. So again, messaging. We got to talk to the lowest common denominator, and we have to blend labor rights, civil rights, and American politics so that we are one united front, one united message. We have to do that. And now's the time. So people always ask me, well, Malin, are you going to run again? Malin, what are you going to do now? What side of the aisle are you going to be on? Are you going to be on labor, or are you going to be with the Democrats, or are you going to be electoral politics? And I say all of them. A wise man once said, I will not be judged today, but by my yesterday. But today I begin again, focused on the successes I will create today. So here we stand. And we got to talk about the successes that we will create as a people, as progressives. What will we create? Well, I'll tell you what I will help to create. I will help to create today a land where we will not take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few. I will help to create today a place in our state where decent family and American values are not trumped by political and corporate interests. I will help to create today a land where winning is based upon your service to your community and what you want to do and what your vision is for the state of Wisconsin, not based upon how much money you can raise nationally. I want to help to create today a place where politics is not about just mudslinging or throwing mud against your opponent, but talking about what your vision is in the future of our state and being focused on the issues and being focused on the politics, not focused on the personalities. But what will you help to create? Well, those who write our history right now will ask, why did the people of the great state of Wisconsin stand up, stand together, and fight back against a divide-and-conquer strategy paralyzing their state? The answer is because we have something worth fighting for. And people always ask me again, am I finished? I say, hell no, I'm not finished. No, I'm not finished fighting. And we cannot be finished. I'm not finished fighting for that single mother in Eau Claire whose daughter has to sleep in the kitchen of a studio apartment just because times have gotten that rough. No, I'm not finished. I'm not finished fighting for that veteran applicant who did two tours in Iraq but came home. Whether you agree with the war or not, that's not the problem. He comes home and he has no home. He has no job. No, I'm not finished fighting for him. I'm not finished fighting for the 10-year-old little girl we're seeing who said, Malin, I go door to door to you because I care about public education and I care about the future. No, I'm not finished. I'm not finished fighting for that single mother teacher in Milwaukee who said that she had to sell her car because her health care premium benefits are getting too high. No, I'm not finished. I'm not finished fighting for that elderly person. I'm not finished. I'm not finished fighting for that elderly person who worked hard, gave back to their community, and all they want to do is retire with some dignity. And now they want to privatize their Social Security and take away their Medicare. No, I'm not finished. And we cannot be finished. I'm not finished fighting for our future, fighting for our children, and fighting for our grandchildren, because the time is now. And we have to do it now. So we have to stand up, get up, move our feet, because people are hurting. People are hurting. I said we have to stand up, get up, and move our feet, because people are hurting. And I'm not finished fighting for what every American deserves. Good jobs, quality education, and affordable health care. And you cannot be finished. Are you finished? Are you finished? Because these values should unite us, not divide us. We cannot be finished. No one said that this will be easy. No one said that this fight will be easy. But you know what? They start this fight. And if it's a fight they want, it's a fight they're going to get. But we got to be ready, armed, and equipped for the battle. We got to bring everything to the game like they used to say back in the old days. Money, marbles, and chalk, everything it takes to play, and we will prevail. Because this is still about justice. And this is still about history. And no one said justice comes easy. No one said history is always easy. But we have to work hard. History has proven that winners don't quit and quitters never win. I can't quit. I won't quit. I can't stop. I won't stop. I'm not going to vote because I'm getting fired up. So let's go. Let's get out there. Our resolve has to be stronger. Our resolve has to be stronger, our pain has to last longer, and our passion has to run deeper, because this is still about justice, this is still about history, this is something bigger than you, this is something bigger than me, and at the end of the day, we will win justice, and this will still be about history, and we will be victorious. Solidarity, brothers and sisters, and God bless the United States of America.
Wow. Yeah, it is funny. 11 years ago, I was much more concerned about the environment than I was about senior citizens. Now, I kind of like that stuff about Social Security. Hightower said, if you're going to trust Romney with Ryan with Social Security, said he'd rather give a coyote his last lamb chop. Anyway, Malin, great job. We have a... Proud to have him as our candidate for Lieutenant Governor. We have something a little bit different, and I think you're going to enjoy it. I watched Buddy Romer during this campaign, and I thought, here's an interesting man who was governor of the state of Louisiana, member of Congress, and now running for president of the United States on a limited budget by saying he wouldn't take more money than $100 per person. He got nowhere, but he got into the hearts of some of us who think that we need to have people from all parties talking about the money in politics. We've got to take back our democracy from those, the Koch brothers and the rest of them, who are trying to dictate who we nominate, who we elect, and who serves. So please join me in welcoming Buddy Romer to join Fighting Bob Fest.
As you can tell from my accent, I'm from southern Wisconsin. Down around Baton Rouge. I woke up this morning and I go outside for a little jog, and I passed the front desk in my hotel and I said, "What's the temperature outside?" He said, 42 degrees. My God. This is summer. I can read the calendar. Fall does not start until September 21st. It was 42 in Baton Rouge once last year. Dead of winter. But it was a beautiful morning. Great run. I think temperature is too important to me. It's been funny all my life like that. I decided I wanted to be in politics when I was working on my father's cotton farm, and my job was a hoe hand. I would take a hoe, and in the summer when we were out of school, my brothers and I would chop cotton. And when the cotton's 4 or 5 foot tall on a hot summer day, it can get to be 110. And after one long day, my father happened to ask me, we were thinking about going to college, he said, "What are you going to be when you grow up? And I said, "I'm not sure, Dad, but I know what I'm not going to be, a cotton farmer." So temperature is always important. I went off to college. I was 16. I was young. I was the youngest person in my class. And I went to some little snooty school up in Boston. And they had offered me a scholarship. You know, I was a bright little kid. And so I just turned 16. And I went. I'd never been to Harvard or Cambridge or Boston before. And one night, my roommate, I had five roommates. One of my roommates said, "It's going to be zero in the morning." I never will forget that night. Whether it was in December or January, he said zero. I couldn't believe of zero. So this was 1960. Shows you how old I am. There was a one of these thermometers outside the Harvard ice hockey rink, and it was digital, 1960, and the temperature was on it, and that was about a mile from our dorm, and I got up throughout the night to go see when it got to be zero, and I can remember I would walk this mile, freezing my tail, and it was four. And so I said, well, I'm going to give it a couple hours. So it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. So I went back. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. It was 2. And so I went back at 5. I didn't go to sleep at all that night. 5 o'clock. I remember it. It was zero. What a great day. I want to start by thanking you for inviting me. Fighting Bob, this fest is world famous, as are you who participate in it and listen to it. And I thank you for inviting me. And I wanted to thank you for New Orleans. I'll leave this afternoon. I'm giving a speech tonight. My granddaddy lived in New Orleans. My daughter lives there now. I live about 70 miles from New Orleans in Baton Rouge. But on behalf of the citizens of New Orleans, I want to thank the citizens of Wisconsin and Madison particularly for helping us. We have rebuilt about half the city. New Orleans was a city of about 610,000. It's now about 295,000. So it's about halfway back. It was the only city in American history that was completely destroyed. 14 foot of water. And it's been a long haul back. So thank you. I'm going to say some things this morning for just a few minutes that I hope will encourage you to stand up with me. But these are going to be hard words. So I have to tell the story about a man, middle-aged. I'm older than middle-aged. I'm 68, but I'll call myself middle-aged. Maybe I'll live to be 136. Who knows? I'm a Methodist, I believe. But there was a middle-aged man who worked hard, and the phone would ring in the office, and his blood pressure would get high. And to relieve stress, he would leave the office some afternoons. Go get in his car, drive out of town, put on a country music station, and listen to rock and roll or country with the windows down, and he'd feel better. It happened to him one day. He went down the 11-story elevator in New Orleans. He got in his sports car. He went outside of town about 10 or 15 miles. He was driving over the hills of South Louisiana. He was feeling better. The windows were down. The music was on. The phone was not ringing. There were never any cars on this road, and he saw a car coming about a mile away, coming over the hills, going pretty fast. And so he kind of gripped the wheel, surprised him, and the car was about 100 yards from him. He went down a dip, disappeared. It came up the upside, and it had moved over into his lane. It was headed right toward him. So he grabbed the wheel. He hit the brakes. His veins popped out on the sides of his head. And the car swerved back into the other lane and passed him. It was driven by a woman. She had her window down and she hollered, "Pig!" and went by. Well, our guy not to be outdone. Thought he was rude as hell. So he said, "Cow!" Went about 50 feet and hit the biggest pig you ever saw. Okay. All right. So, I spent 20 years as a Democrat. I spent 20 years as a Republican. And now I'm a proud independent. And I'm going to use some pig words and some cow words, but listen to me. This is about us. By the way, I found both parties basically the same. Addicted to the money. Addicted to the money. Don't try to go into a cloakroom and find the truth. I spent 8 years in the Congress. First, and I'm going to make 4 points. First, I'm optimistic about America. I think it's the greatest form of representative democracy on earth. No kings, no military dictators, no military generals, no one party runs this country. We do. We do. We do. Abraham Lincoln said it best, the greatest president. Don't fool yourself. He was a Whig. He changed parties to be a Republican, to stand with the abolitionists. They asked him one day when he was running for president, "What document represents America the most? What do you hold the most dear in America?" And you know what Abe Lincoln said? He didn't say the Constitution. He said the Declaration of Independence. It cannot be amended. We the people, life, liberty, and the poor, we're a nation in trouble. Oh, I know it's a political season and one party always says we're a nation in trouble and the other party always says we're a nation in trouble elected and nonsense. I've lived through Clinton and Bush and now Obama. Clinton did away with Glass-Steagall. Bush did too big to fail. And Obama changed neither of them. That's where we are. That's where we are. We're a nation in trouble. I'll give you some numbers. Last month, 400,000 Americans quit looking for work. 400,000 last month. We have 8.1% unemployed. We have 5 million people permanently unemployed. 47 weeks or longer. We had 425,000 new people on food stamps last month. Last month, that's almost 15,000 a day. We have fewer people working in America today than we did in 1999, and there are 41 million more Americans. We have lost half our manufacturing jobs in 20 years. NAFTA, CAFTA, blind eye to China. I've been to China more times than Obama and Romney combined. I've walked the streets. I've been to the plants. My first trip to China was in 92. All paid by me. My billfold. I wanted to see. I wanted to know. They work children. They work 12 hours a day. They work 6 days a week. I've seen women with a child strapped around their waist on a rope while they worked in the plants. And does America say anything? Not a word. They raised the tariff on Chrysler automobiles 2 months ago. 22%. Did the president say a word? Not one word. I'm in Los Angeles during the campaign about a year ago. By the way, he said I didn't do very well at the campaign. I raised over $1 million. I had 100,000 people contribute. That's more than any other candidate who ran. 100,000 people. I paid every bill. I was the only candidate in the Republican primary, the only candidate who'd been elected a governor and a congressman, and I didn't get invited to a single debate. They didn't want to hear me. I understand. I'm in Los Angeles, and the new leader of the party of China, Xi, was giving a speech. I slipped in to listen. You know, I'm the one that gave the speech in front of the Chinese embassy in Washington about unfair trade. I'm a trader. I know how the global economy works. I love to have free trade, but if I can't, it must be fair. And I listened to him talk about how he honored the city of Los Angeles and the port of Los Angeles for the $133 billion in trade. Well, I'm the only guy in the room that knew what the facts were. $122 billion goes from China to Los Angeles, and $11 billion goes from Los Angeles to China. That's not trade. That's surrender. I worry about America. Manufacturing jobs down by half. 15% of the people work part-time only. They can't support their own family. They can't find a full-time job. They work two and three jobs. 11 million people on Social Security disability. 11 million Americans. 3 years ago, that number was 5 million. Wages per hour are shrinking. The quit rate is the lowest measured in America's history. That's the people who voluntarily quit their job and go look for another one. It's almost zero. Women have never had a rougher time in a recession than this one. They've actually lost jobs for the first time in American history. Blacks have no chance. Youth are dead on the street in terms of jobs. College grads have the largest unemployment rate in American history. We're in a depression, but it's quiet. It's invisible because the check's in the mail. There are no breadlines. And the elite have never had it so good. Look at them. Watch them. They've never had it so good. Wall Street have never had these profits. Goldman Sachs. I call them Goldman friggin' Sachs. And I went to the Harvard Business School after I got out of money. I know these guys. I know them well. I know them all. They were the largest giver to Obama and McCain. They gave to both of them millions of dollars. Broke every rule in the banking book, and not one soul went to jail. Look, the big boy, there are two Americas. Have you figured it out? There are two Americas. One never had it so good, and the other is afraid, hanging on. It doesn't have to be that way. The big boys discovered something. I don't know when they discovered it. 10 years ago, 20 years ago. This is not an Obama problem. This is our problem. The big boys discovered something. Washington's not just broken, it's bought. They discovered they can buy it. They're for rent. Don't try to call and talk to your congressman and get in the way of a Washington fundraiser. You've got no chance. You know who the Congress works for? Whoever signs their check. I say it's institutionally corrupt. When a big check can get first in line and a young woman with a good idea is last, That's institutionally corrupt. That's not the way America was. That's not the way America should be. We have a tax code you cannot read. We have a tax code where GE can make $15.4 billion and pay not one penny in federal income tax. Oh, it's worse than that. We have a tax code written so that GE can close a plant in America and open the plant in China, and we taxpayers pay for it because they deduct the expenses from their revenue. And by the way, you know where they sell these products that they make in China from the plants closed in America? They sell them back in America because we are free traders. No tariffs on those goods. Wow. You know who wrote the tax bill, don't you? It wasn't Obama. He didn't even know what's in it. It wasn't President Bush. He didn't even know what's in it. It wasn't the Congress. They don't even know what's in it. It was the lobbyists. They write the tax code. Bank reform, too big to fail, Glass-Steagall, capital ratios ought to go up. Has any of that been done? President Obama signs the bank reform bill. I try not to blame him. I like him. There hadn't been many presidents I liked. I like him. I like him as a person. But he signs this bank reform bill with this big ceremony. It's a piece of garbage. And the next day, he goes to Wall Street. The next day, goes to Wall Street, has a fundraiser, $35,400 a ticket, and guess who the host is? Friggin' Goldman Sachs. Come on. Healthcare reform. I'm a diabetic. 50 years. There it is. Insulin pump. Made in Sweden. Don't make them in America. All the idea and the patent is held in America, but not the manufacturing plant. We needed, I supported President Obama. We need health care reform. But he went the wrong way. He got the lobbyists, the lawyers, the insurance companies, and the pharmaceuticals in the room. That's not who you need. You need the nurses and the patients and the doctors in the room. Come on. Come on. We can boom in this country. We can do it. We're this close. It can be done. And it can be done quickly. Regulatory reform. Don't eliminate the regulations. You need a speed limit on the highways. But don't treat a company run by a woman that's doing a project with 5 employees the same as if she was General Electric. The regulations can be different. Can be different. We need trade reform, a level playing field. We need energy reform. I'm an environmentalist. We can produce energy in this country environmentally right. We did it in Louisiana. All the big oil companies fought me. I mean, they would see red in the face. But we increased production and lowered the cost of the air and water. It can be done. We can't do it, though, with bundled money, with special interest money, with lobbyist money. The givers get, and the rest of us pay. Here's my solution, and I'll close with this last point. I'm very specific. I got 7% in the Gallup poll a week before I dropped out of the race 2 months ago. 7%. Not on a single debate. No one knew me. I was known by 15% of the American people, and half of them were voting for me. And here's the issue. The first step is not tax reform. The first step to growth and jobs and justice is not budget reform. It's not health care reform. It's not trade reform. It's campaign reform. You've got to... Full disclosure. Sunlight in every transaction. Full disclosure, number one. Number two, 48-hour reporting. Not 2 weeks, not 2 months, not 2 years, 48 hours. Number three, criminal penalties if you violate these laws. Number four, PACs cannot give more than individuals. Now they can give 5,000, individuals 2,500. Whatever the limit is, it affects everybody. Number four, no lobbyist can bring a check. Bring an idea. Bring a need. Bring a tear. But don't bring a check. Number five, no super PACs. They're illegal. Now, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not standing before the Supreme Court, but Citizens United says that the super PACs working in America are illegal. Here's what it says. There can be no coordination between the super PAC and the campaign. Mitt Romney spoke to the fundraiser of his own darn super PAC. Is that coordination? You betcha. They're illegal. President Obama named his key people serving in Washington to raise money for his own super PAC. That's coordination. I'm not a fool. They're illegal. And Congress ought to have the guts to stand up and say it. Number six. No retiring congressman can lobby Congress for 7 years after retirement. And finally, we ought to have public funding of campaigns that set a limit on the amount they would accept. Let me show you how it would work. If you set a $100 limit, I can be elected president at $100. Let me tell you why. If I were to run for 4 years like this, I win. Now watch me. If I get 5 million people to give me $100 each, that's 500 million and they can't beat me. It can be done. If you agree to set a $100 limit and to get money from your district that you're representing, then we, the taxpayers, would put up, match you 4-1. 4-1. And we would have the kind of elections where people would run. We don't need two parties. We need 20. We don't need one ideas. We need 15. We need more people involved. It can be done. And what's the cost? You know, I'm one of these bankers. I've heard you say we don't want to be tight with the money. Some places we need to be tight with the money. We have 1,155 foreign bases. That's about 800 too many. I mean, there are a lot of ways you can reduce the budget in this country, without hurting people, without stopping jobs, without hurting children. You can do it. One of the places we ought to spend a little money on is public funding for these kind of campaigns. It would cost you $3 billion a year. That's all. And you would choose where the money goes. Every person would get a $50 tax voucher. And you decide what candidate or what party you contribute. Let me close. We start with reform, and not any one of the two candidates for president even mentions the word. They're not going to make any changes. I was so hopeful with Obama. I was. I liked him. And he talked about change. And, you know, I know John McCain all my life and fought the wars with him, trust him and honored him. But I liked Obama. Change. Did it come? No. Got to start with the money. You got to start with campaign reform. If you were to join me, not me, but people like me, I'm 68. I'm too old to be president now. It'll be some one of you. But we can do this. We can do this. I'm going to stand with you. I'm going all over America. I'm in Denver next week and watch the crowds. I'm in Los Angeles the week after that. And then San Francisco. I'm going all over America. I'm of enough age and I've worked hard and saved my money. I'm giving it back. We can do this. It's going to take you doing two things. And you're not going to like it. But I'm your doctor on this one. I've been there. This is not theoretical to me. I've been in the Oval Office more times than I care to mention. When Reagan was president and I was a Democrat, head of the boll weevils. And we turned this country around. We did. Across party lines. We've got a bill from the center where it's the strongest. Two things you have to do. Sacrifice. And get involved, each one of you. Get on my website. That's a place to start. It's not the only place. It's called thereformproject.org. Get on it. Thereformproject.org. We are picking candidates across America. We educate them. We're picking those who should win. We're going to elect members of Congress. I'm not trying to form a party. I'm trying to build a nation. I can't do it without you. I'll close with this one story. Guy loved to go fishing. He was 6 years old. He asked his dad, he said, "Dad, let's go fishing." Dad worked, good man, worked hard. He put that first. And he said, "I would do it in a couple weeks, son, I promise you." A couple weeks came and went. He asked his dad, he said, "Let's go fishing." "No, we'll do it, son. I'm really busy right in a couple of weeks, I promise." 3 weeks came and went, 4 weeks, and he said, "Dad, let's go fishing." And Dad said, "Well, when? When?" And the boy said, "Let's do it Saturday. Let's go Saturday morning." This was a Tuesday. And the man said, "All right, this Saturday we're going fishing. I'll put my work off one day." Saturday morning came, it was cold, it was wet, about 42, raining. And the dad said, I asked the boy, he said, "You want to go? It's miserable." And he said, "Let's go, Dad." They went fishing. Daybreak, got the boat. Got on the lake. Didn't catch a nibble. You know how it is. You've been there. Not a nibble. Spent most of the day, ate a sandwich. By mid-afternoon, it got worse, and so they came home. And Mama didn't say anything. They dragged in the house, father and son. Took off their rain jackets and got out of their clothes. Took a bath. Ate supper that night, didn't say much. Dad said to his boy, said, "I'm sorry, son." Boy didn't say anything. That night, before Mom and Dad went to sleep, they heard their son in the little small farmhouse, that little thin wall. They heard him say his six-year-old prayers. "Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. And thank you, God. Thank you for a great day of fishing. Spend all day with Daddy." It's not about the fish. It's not about which party wins. It's about us. Stand with me. Thank you.
I told you you were in for a treat. Interesting. I guess my biggest mistake is I never took my daughters fishing. But when Buddy Romer talks about the system is broken, I can tell you, as one who's run for office and tried to get money from people and from corporations, not from corporations, but from unions and so on, everybody wants something in return if you get a big check from them. As Paul Simon used to say, nobody gives you $5,000 because you look good. And he said, and in particular your case, Ed. So if you ask, anytime you talk to a group of students, ask them if they've ever had anyone come up to them and say, well, I'd like to give you $1,000. What question would you ask? And inevitably they say, what do you want? Nobody gives $1,000 or $5,000 or $10,000 to somebody unless they want something in return. So I think what Buddy Romer is saying is, unless we can reform the system, we're not going to change any of the other things. Mike McCabe will be leading the workshop this afternoon. Of course, says that whatever your top priority is, it has to become number two, because number one has to be campaign finance reform. Get the money out of politics. Bob La Follette made it possible to get the corporations not to contribute. And we now have the disgrace of corporations pouring money into campaigns. It is an absolute disgrace. Try to explain this system to someone from Europe in a democracy where they listen to us constantly say we're the greatest nation in the history of the world. You look at our politics and you're going to have to ask yourself if that's really true. Someone who fought side by side with us for campaign finance reform and for educational reform, and a true progressive and someone who understands agriculture as well as business and education, is Stan Grzynski. And Stan is one of my, in fact, he is my favorite former legislator, because he was always available, always working hard, always stimulating thought, always challenging people to do better. And so please welcome Stan Grzynski. And he's very intelligent.
Thank you, Ed. Well, once again, it's humbling to be here. I mean, I'm standing behind the stage listening to Buddy Romer and Malin Mitchell before that. And I think to myself, why am I here? Okay. First of all, they've said everything that I'd like to talk about, and they've said it better. So that's a little unnerving. And then I think when Ed invited me to come again, and I enjoy and appreciate the invitation, I asked him what his theme was, what he'd like me to talk about. And he said, well, talk a little bit about money. I'm thinking, me? You want me to talk about money? Well, anyway, I'm here. And I'm happy for the fact that I could follow Buddy Romer and Malin Mitchell, because it sort of reminds me about why I chose a course in public life, and it sort of reinforced the message that I want to leave with all of you today. And that is that we have an obligation as citizens. In the final analysis, no matter how unhappy we are with what's happening in this system, or how, in fact, it's controlled by money, the political system, and it is controlled by money. There's no question about it. Or the kinds of legislation we're getting, or the courts, the way the courts that are ruling. That isn't prospective. That's happening now, today. It's happening to us. So we can't just wish it away. We've really got to get involved ourselves in doing something about it. I had an odd thing happen to me, although it seems sometimes to me that a lot of my life is an odd thing. But I was listening to the Democratic convention, and I was listening to President Obama's acceptance speech. And he struck on citizenship. I don't know how many of you listened to the speech, but he talked about the responsibilities of citizenship. And, you know, we throw that word around, you know, what it means to be a citizen, the kinds of things we need to be thinking about as citizens, what we're entitled to as citizens, what sort of life we want as citizens. But it prompted me to think about citizenship. And I remembered the first time I heard the word. It was in the fourth grade in a one-room schoolhouse in a little township, Porterfield, Wisconsin, where I grew up, where Mrs. Schrader said, "Today we're going to talk about civics." Now, this is a word you don't hear so much these days. But she wrote on the board. And I remember this because we all had to write it down and kind of memorize it. And of course, I was used to writing things on the board over and over again because, well, I was not exactly a model student, if you want to catch my drift, but I was an active student. But she said that citizenship is the right and responsibility of every person to be involved in their government and do what they can to make sure everyone is treated fairly and has equal rights under the law. Now, that's pretty simple and straightforward, isn't it? I mean, it sounds almost like a made-up description of citizenship. And for all I know, Mrs. Schrader made it up. But as I think about it today, and as I thought about it the other night, I thought how true and accurate that is, and how much of it we as citizens tend to forget. Now, as I was listening to Buddy Romer speak about the way money has taken control of our political process, and how hard it is for us to recognize at times the country we live in today as the country that we grew up with as a notion, I realize that it's a failure on our part to exercise our citizenship. Now, I just want you to know that I fault no one for this. I mean, things happen the way they happen. I grew up on a farm. I know my parents had aspirations for that farm to be a certain way, to produce certain things, that certain years there would be certain crops that would be productive, that we would be able to make a little money so we could buy a better car or eventually send their kids to college or whatever. It didn't always work out that way. The forces around them changed it a little bit. And the forces around us in our society here in the United States has changed us. I do believe that we are a country that puts wealth and money first. We think that that's the most important thing. Ed mentioned that I worked on education issues. I chaired the Colleges and Universities Committee when I was in the legislature. I watched our universities change. It wasn't a devious plot on someone's part to reduce the sort of general liberal arts education that Wisconsin had been so noted for. It was just a kind of a migration toward the idea that we had to get kids pushed through the system, trained to do a certain type of work, so they could make a certain amount of money and support the system that existed out there. And more the critical thinking went by the wayside. And more our young people thought about how important it was to get an education so they could get a good job and survive in this sort of competitive society. And that's the sort of thing that we're dealing with now. We are dealing with people, my neighbors included. Sometimes I fall victim to this myself, where I'll come home and I'll sit down and I'll say, "There, I'm done. I did my part for today. So now I'd like to see what's on television, or maybe do nothing." And you know, we can't have it that way. One of the reasons that my parents were successful on the farm is that we worked hard at farming, and it didn't begin at a set time in the morning or end at a certain time in the afternoon or evening. It was an around-the-clock job. We were to take it seriously, more seriously some days than others. And that same rule, in my opinion, applies to citizenship. Would I like President Obama to do more? Yes, I would. Would I like our Congress to do more and better reflect my values? Yes, I would. But I'll tell you something. I haven't done enough in terms of my own responsibilities as they relate to citizenship to bring the larger audience in to make those sorts of things happen. I've got some sad news for you. You can wish until the cows come home for change, and it's not going to happen. We are locked into this system.
We are locked into this system. But here is the good news. And I think Martin Luther King said it best, although I don't think that he is credited with this as his quote. I think it was probably a modification on something that someone else said. He said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." Now, I believe that this nation and our founding fathers understood justice. They understood fairness. They understood opportunity. They understood, as well as they could, democracy and how it should be exercised. But they also believed that citizens had to be engaged in that process, which is why they created a constitution and a rule of law that allowed for flexibility and change, allowed for people to be involved and engaged. And that's what we each need to do. It should not just be the responsibilities of our people in Congress, our president, our governors, or our elected officials to do it. We ought to be on top of this. We ought to be paying attention to it. We need to talk to our friends and our neighbors and our families, no matter how uncomfortable it gets at times. If it's too uncomfortable, dial it down a little bit. Even I have to do that from time to time, as Paula will tell you. She'll say, "I can hear you, Stan. You're sitting next to me." But we have to engage. We need to get involved. We need to embrace our responsibilities as citizens. Ed said early on, as he was talking a little bit about where Fighting Bob will go from here, and I want to commend him for all the work he's done with this, how he's hung in there over the years, facing the adversity that you face when you try to challenge the system. He said, "We need to decide where we're going to take Fighting Bob." Well, I have a suggestion. We take Fighting Bob home. We take it home with us. We take these values home and we begin to talk a little bit to our friends and our neighbors and our families about the things that are happening in this country and how this change is undermining the opportunities for the future. How this change is moving us away from a country that is compassionate and wants to afford opportunity to a country that thinks only in terms of who has and how you can keep it. We need to change that. And the only way we're going to get that sort of change is if people like yourselves elect to get beyond your comfort zone. If people like myself decide that just ranting to Paula or to my kids is enough. I have to figure out a way to communicate beyond that. And so do you. I think I mentioned in another talk, these events usually happen around Labor Day, that Labor Day is one of my favorite holidays. The reason it is because I think it gives license for me to get together with my four kids and anyone else they drag along to talk about the important contributions that labor has made to society, why I'm a Democrat, why I do the things that I do. I talk to them about government and all those other things. And, of course, this time around, I talked a little bit about money and my concern that money has a stranglehold on this country and that we all have to do more to take us back to where we ought to be in terms of who we are as a nation. And one of my sons said to me, "You know what I don't get, Dad, is if we have a shrinking middle class and if more and more wealth is controlled by fewer and fewer people, don't the wealthy people see that this isn't in their interest?" And I said, "Well, Adam, that would be looking at it from your perspective, all right? If you look at it from their perspective, well, I can just give you the flat-out general answer, no, okay? No, they don't think that way. But here's the sadder thing about this. I really do believe when you get to the point where you have more money than you know what to do with, realistically, when you begin hiding your money, whether it's in the Swiss bank accounts or the Cayman Islands or wherever you want to hide it, when you get to that point, you have to seriously consider if it is not a disease and an addiction beyond your control. Don't you think that? I mean, how do you spend billions of dollars realistically? And if you can't spend it to have a good life and help your friends and neighbors and family around you, then what is your motivation? Well, the motivation must be that it's a sickness or a disease, that you can see the limits. You know how much money is out there, and we know all of this now. We know how many resources there are in the world. We can project how long they're going to last. We know where they're hidden and which, not hidden, but where they're deposited in which country, if you're talking about minerals or forest products or natural resources of any type or agricultural productive capacity, all of this is known. But instead of thinking in terms of how we can take those resources, those limited resources, and use them to the benefit of the whole world, we're thinking now about how we can keep those resources only at our benefit to the denigration of the rest of the world, physical and human population combined. That needs to change. And it isn't going to change simply by hoping that someone else gets elected different from the person that's representing you if you don't agree with that person. It's only going to change if each of us decides to renew our citizenship, to establish in our own minds, in our own families, the effort and the initiative that it's going to take to bring things around. Martin Luther King had it right. It bends toward justice. I would not be standing here before you today if I thought that this was futile or a hopeless case. Is it a challenge? Yes. But as my dad told me, as I was cleaning out a calf pen that seemed impossible, this will build character. That's what he told me. And while it looked like it couldn't, it did. And while it looked like I couldn't get it done, I cleaned out the calf pen. And cleaning out that calf pen at an early age in my life helped me realize that I could do other things around the farm that were even more challenging, that would contribute to the greater good of that farm. And I don't see where that's so disconnected from what our responsibilities are as citizens. You know, this is a country of, by, and for the people. That it isn't a country for the people, for the people, for the people. It's of, by, and for the people. In other words, the government is run by citizens. So when we criticize public servants and people who are running the federal government or the state government or the local governments down in the bureaucracies, we are criticizing our friends and neighbors. And frankly, for all those patriots out there, that's not very patriotic in my mind. All right? This democracy is created and established the way it is so it becomes a learning and a training ground for citizenship. If we make mistakes at the local, state, or national level, these are our friends and neighbors trying to learn to do a better job. And by the way, we would like them to do a little better job, maybe some of the critics ought to put a little bit less money into a process that has the wrong people in charge much of the time. But it comes back to our responsibilities. It comes back to those basic values that I learned as a kid. It comes back to what Mrs. Schrader wrote on that chalkboard about citizenship, the responsibility that we each have to not only enjoy the freedoms of this country, but to contribute to making it a better and stronger nation each and every day. That's what Ed does with his Fighting Bob effort and initiative that he's engaged all these years. That's why you're spending time here today. And that's why when we meet again in a year from now, we each should come back and be able to tell a story that we in some way improved the lives and the conditions and the values of this country. Thank you very much. Huh?
Very good. Thank you, Stan Grzynski. The raging grannies are still raging, and they're now going to be set up. And while they're setting up, we're going to pass the buckets, because, as you know, we have to raise money at this event in order to keep going. is if we don't have the money, we can't keep getting good speakers to come here. So please pull out your wallets, pick out a couple of bills and see what they look like and dump them in the bucket when they come around. So they'll be passing buckets all up and down here. And if you have more money to give than you think would be safe with us, call us and we'll have somebody from security follow you around, make sure that you're okay. So please welcome the Raging Grannies as they get started very soon. At least we want to welcome them to the stage right now.
Battered, feeling a little blue, a little bruised around the edges. Well, we're here and we're feeling it too. So here to cheer you up today are the Raging Grannies singing about the year that was, the environment that didn't get fixed, the guns on the ground, the drones in the air, our collective women's body parts, our lack of single-payer health care. But most of all, we're not giving up. And we want you to sing with us. So take a look in your program. The next to the last page, it says, Sing Along with the Raging Grannies. And that is the next thing you're going to do. We are not giving up.
Crying. don't say vagina. I guess this is another word we shouldn't say. How absurd. Don't say vagina. We're not afraid to touch it under covers. Now listen to advice from your grandma.
Now, this next song we've offered as a theme song for the National Rifle Association. But so far, the NRA hasn't taken us up on that.
We sell guns, lots of guns, to anyone who wants. Comes hit of target of this.
It'll be just a few minutes while the raging grannies get off the stage, but aren't they wonderful? Please give another round of applause. In order to save time, I'm going to ask you, does anyone here not know Jim Hightower? If so, if you don't know him, or you've never heard of him, or you haven't listened to him, raise your hand. Will you two please leave? Jim Hightower is, as far as I'm concerned, the most important part of every Bob Fest, because he brings to us a popular spirit and really an enthusiasm and an optimism that is absolutely essential. And besides that, he's a hell of a lot of fun to be with. And so please welcome Jim Hightower, since you all know him. No reason for me to introduce him. No, where's the real Hightower? Thank you.
Thank you. Tremendous to follow the grannies up here. I thought of them because of your man, Ryan Paul, down here in Janesville, claimed that he had run a marathon in under 3 hours, which was pretty substantial. That would be Olympic level. But it turns out, of course, that it was over 4 hours. But what you may not know is it was in the Grandma's Marathon in Duluth, Minnesota. I don't think Paul Ryan could outrun the grannies here, do you? And what a joy to be back at Bob Fest with our pal Ed Garvey. I've often thought that we should get a bill passed in the Congress declaring Ed Garvey one of America's most precious natural resources. But I gave that up because have you seen what they do to America's most precious natural resources? I don't think it'd be a good thing overall. Well, makes me happier than a mosquito at a nudist colony to be standing up here looking out at all of you feisty fighting Bob Festers, you corporate greed whackers and Republican butt kickers, as we all of us Garveyistas come together in this colossal coliseum of calm contemplation to mount a grassroots counterinsurgency against the corporate greed heads and political boneheads who have hung a for sale sign on our national and state governments. There are many ways, I think, to express how we the people feel about that for sale sign and what it is that we want to be done. But I think it's already been summed up by another sign that is on an iconic place in my hometown called Austin Motel. It's got an old-time big old marquee out front that declares no additives, no preservatives, corporate free since 1938. Wouldn't that be good? Sadly, we're a long way from being able to hang that sign on either our national or state governments. You know, there's an old cowboy saying out in West Texas, speak the truth, but ride a fast horse. And the truth is, of course, that our government has become a wholly owned subsidiary of Wall Street and the corporate elite, who are openly supplanting our democracy with their kleptocracy, a government of thieves, of by and far the bankers and bosses, the big shots, bastards, and bullshitters who think that they are entitled to run roughshod over we the people. Now, we know who to thank for this sellout. And let us call their names and remember their names and repeat it every chance we get. Sam Alito, Anthony Kennedy, John Roberts, Antonin Scalia, and Clarence Thomas. The five black-robed thugs who mugged the American people with an assault gun called Citizens United. Anthony Kennedy, the learned judge who wrote this dreadful opinion, actually rationalized it by declaring, and I've got it right here, declaring, "We now conclude that political expenditures, including those made by corporations, do not give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption." Now, I know Supreme Court judges are highly educated, but you read something like that and you think, 100,000 sperm and you were the fastest? Of course, unlimited corporate cash is going to corrupt our elections. The Supremes, they were confused at all on the concept. They could have looked back to the candid comments of the convicted savings and loan scoundrel, Charles Keating, back in the 1980s. He was asked at a Senate hearing later whether the $1.5 million that he doled out to key committee members to be able to pull his scandals had bought any political favors. And Keating responded, "I certainly hope so." They don't do this by accident. They don't put this money into members of Congress just because they want good government. They want their government. They want the government that will serve them. Our friend Molly Ivins some years ago told a story, a great story about this money in politics. She told about a state senator who had gotten elected out in the Abilene area and came to Austin for the first time. And first thing, of course, he met a lobbyist. And the lobbyist said, "I'm going to need your vote tomorrow in this committee. Here's $200. And so the senator put it in his pocket and thought, well, this is going to be all right. And the next day came the vote, and lo and behold, the senator voted against the lobbyist. So the lobbyist, you know, said, "What the hell are you doing? My God, I gave you $200. And the senator said, "Well, the other side offered me $400. And so the lobbyist exploded, the lobbyist exploded all over the senator talking about integrity and, responsibility in government, ethics. And the senator, you know, pulled himself up with all the respectability that he could and said, "Well, you knew I was weak when I took the $200. Well, of course, as Molly wrote again and again, it's not about the $200 and the $400. It's not about this state senator or that one. It's about the corrupt system money that allows anybody to put in now unlimited sums of money. Keating's $1.5 million, well, that bought some influence. But the corporate billionaires of today are out to buy the whole shebang. They jumped on Citizen United like a gator on a poodle. Sheldon Adelson, the casino baron out of Las Vegas, got casinos coast to coast here, got a casino in China, got a casino now in Spain. Sheldon Adelson has already spent $35 million that he gave to Republican candidates for president, including $10 million so far to Mitt Romney. He's also given $36 million so far to Karl Rove's secret political action committee, and to the Koch brothers' operations, and to Eric Cantor, the majority leader of the Republican House, to their PACs. He says he'll spend $100 million or more to defeat Obama. Now, $100 million from one person or more. Now, I think if you spend $100 million, shouldn't you get naming rights to the campaign? I mean, you got, Alliant got the naming rights to this facility right here. I mean, shouldn't for $100 million you get the Sheldon Adelson, Mitt Romney, Flim Flam campaign or something like that? You ought to have your name up there. And by the way, I don't know if you saw, but Mitt Romney's $1 million-plus donors, they had their own little private tete-a-tete down in Tampa at their convention there aboard a yacht. And that yacht is a 150-foot yacht, pretty nice boat. It's called the Cracker Bay. And guess what flag the Cracker Bay was flying? The Cayman Islands. Is that just absolutely perfect? The home of Mitt's money. I mean, there it was. And his guests got off the yacht to get in their SUVs and go to the next event. The millionaires, some media was there, so they covered up their name tags with their hands. not even willing to disclose their name. It was like a perp walk of political mobsters. Just astonishing to watch. One more. Guess who was a Romney delegate to the Republican convention? David Koch. He was a delegate there. Now, Koch has promised to lay out $400 million to defeat Obama and elect their boy, Mitt, whose energy plan is a Koch wet dream, I can assure you of that. There even was a tribute to David Koch in Tampa. It was called Salute to Entrepreneurs Building America. An entrepreneur who inherited a fortune from his daddy. Yeah, that's entrepreneurial power right there. Well, guess who put on this salute? David Koch. This is why Lily Tomlin has said, no matter how cynical you get, it is almost impossible to keep up. Now, to see what this conspiracy of thieves will do to America's egalitarian ideals, look at the Romney-Ryan tax plan, the Niebuhr-Du plan. Niebuhr-Du is Robin Hood spelled backwards. The intentional inequity of their tax policy prompted the president to say to a crowd in Georgia, the super-rich create loopholes to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. This made it possible for millionaires to pay nothing, while a bus driver is paying 10% of his salary, and that's crazy. Do you think the millionaire ought to pay more in taxes than the bus driver, he asked the crowd, or less? And the crowd roared back, more. That wasn't Barack Obama. It wasn't Bill Clinton. It was Ronald Reagan in 1985. Well, how far the Republicans have come, huh? In only 30 years, we've gone from Ronald Reagan's trickle-down economics to the Koch brothers' tinkle-down economics. They're now peddling the same old snake oil that poisoned our grassroots economy and the Bush-Cheney regime. But Romney says that his experience as a financial vulture at Bain Capital gives him the know-how to fix our economy. Of course, he uses fix in the same word that a veterinarian does. And those of you looking at me blankly, you need to ask your dog about that. Well, this brings us to us, you and me. What is a progressive Bob La Follette little D Democrat to do? Well, first, we need to get behind those who actually advance the cause, who represent real change, like Tammy Baldwin here in Wisconsin, Elizabeth Warren, of course, over in Massachusetts. We've got We have so many strong candidates who are running that you don't hear a whole lot about. Those two you do, but you don't hear a whole lot about them. But you can go to ProgressiveDemocratsOfAmerica.com or various other organizations out there and learn about these candidates who are really standing up and fighting. And by the way, the other group that advanced the cause and who represent real change are those Wisconsin state senators and legislators who stood with us in the great fight in this state. And what a sweet little victory it was yesterday from the court, right? As Ed Garvey keeps saying, it's not over until it's over, and it's not over. We just keep incrementally making progress, and you are making progress. The media tried to say that you were defeated in that recall election. You were not. You forced a recall on a sitting governor with tens of millions of dollars from the Koch brothers and et cetera to force him to have a recall election. Then you pushed him to the wall, and then he barely won, and you took over the state Senate, and you created a statewide organization that will keep moving, that will keep progressing. Wisconsin will be back. Now, second thing that we little d Democrats have to do, we progressives have to do, I believe. I know some will disagree, but because I know that so many of us, including me, have lost that loving feeling for Barack Obama, we progressives, I think, have a special duty, if necessary, to lift him like a sack of concrete and carry him to victory. Not because of him. Because he has disappointed us. He's done many good things. He has disappointed us, and he will disappoint us again. But because of us, and because of our steadily developing grassroots movement, with a Romney-Ryan administration and a Koch-owned Congress, we'll be hurled back to the deeply negative, defensive crouch, devoting all of our time and energy and resources and creativity to fending off the horrors and losing the grassroots momentum we've got going with hundreds of progressive campaigns at a grassroots level all across this country. Obama is a marker that will stay there. We can use him as a marker to hold what we've got. Rather than having to move into negative battles, we can still continue to fight the progressive battles at a grassroots level, which is where the fight really has to be made anyway, as we learned here in Wisconsin. The third thing that we can do, and this one I think is most essential, we must, we really must, that word gets overused, but I think we must team up across issue lines to repeal the Supreme Court's Citizen United anti-democratic abomination with a constitutional amendment. The good news is that this effort is well underway and getting stronger than hog's breath, I can tell you that. As more groups join in and people learn that we can indeed pass a constitutional amendment to kill this zombie of corporate personhood and eliminate corporate cash in our elections. This is not something that we have to convince the American people that it's a good idea. 87% of the American people support a constitutional amendment to eliminate corporate money in our politics. 75% of Republicans support that. So what all we have to do is to collect up that energy, to organize that thought, and to move that forward. Washington is not going to do it. Neither party is going to make this happen, because that's where the money has power. But out here in the countryside, people have power. They got the fat cats, but we got the alley cats. And there are more of us than there are of them. So we've got this opportunity to do it. Seven states, both houses of the legislature, have already passed resolutions calling on the Congress to send a constitutional amendment to the people so the people can vote on getting corporate money out. 68 cities have done so, including right here in Madison. In fact, yes, April of last year, 84% of you voted for a resolution that says, resolve, the city of Madison, Wisconsin calls for reclaiming the democracy from corrupting effects of undue corporate influence by amending the United States Constitution to establish that, one, only human beings, not corporations, are entitled to constitutional rights, and two, money is not speech. It's pretty straightforward. More than 100 national groups have already signed on to this. Here's listings of them. It's astonishing. People for the American Way, Public Citizen, they've been in the leadership of it. Progressive Democrats of America, Common Cause, CWA, Communication Workers of America, SEIU, Color of Change, National Congress of Black Women, Physicians for a National Health Program, Rainforest Network, Move On, U.S. PIRG, Coffee Party USA, Center for Science and the Public Interest, DEMOS, Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, the Hip Hop Caucus, Institute for Policy Studies, 350.org, Bill McKibben's organization, Rebuild the Dream, Van Jones' organization, Working Families Party, the Main Street Alliance, Sierra Club, National Education Association, Food and Water Watch, the 99% Declaration, Unitarian Universalists, Veterans for Peace, right on down the line. This, it's astonishing to get these organizations to team up into one thing. And we, with a few more teaming up, we will make this happen. So I'm saying, too, that whatever else you are involved in through the issue that you care most about, put some effort into this. Go to unitedforthepeople.org. Sign up and get involved in this. That's United for the number four, unitedforthepeople.org. You know, this is our chance to really make a difference. We're in the throes of a real revolution here, a revolution of the oligarchs to take power from we the people. So my message to you, and I'm sure you're wondering what it is by now, is this. It's up to us. Up to us. It always has been in this country. The powers that be don't do it for us. They do it to us. We've got to be the power. And it's the ordinary folks who have always developed progress, put a little progress in progressive in our country by doing this kind of grassroots work. It's not up to Obama. It's not up to a Democratic Congress. It's up to us. My last book with Susan DeMarco, we told a story about a guy who was a tourist in Thailand. He was in Bangkok, actually. And he came out of the Great Temple. And in the glare of the sunlight, there was a monk standing over here in full regalia. So he indicated to the monk, could I snap your picture? And the monk nodded and posed. He took the picture. And then the tourist turned to a boy over here who was selling water. And he went over and got a bottle of water and paid for it and waited for his change, which was not forthcoming. And he said to the boy, he thought there was a language problem, so he said to the boy, exaggerated indication, don't I get change, pointing to his palm. And the boy looked up at him and then looked over at the monk and then looked back and then said in perfect English, change comes from within. And indeed it does. It comes from within us, from within our hearts and within the countryside itself. So we've got to just keep pushing. That's my real message. Keep pushing, but only more so. Do a little bit more, because these are big times. They're trying to steal our America from us. They're trying to steal those ideals of economic fairness, social justice, equal opportunity for all people. That's what they're taking from us. That's what's at stake. That's why you are so important. I'll leave you with this. Intensify your effort. In the words of Louis Grizzard, the late great Southern humorist, he pointed out something that we in the South have always known to be true, and that's that there's a great big difference between being naked and being naked. Being naked means you have no clothes on. But being naked, that means you have no clothes on and you are up to something. So let's all get naked together.
Thank you very much. Glad to be with you. Thanks to Bob Fest. Keep moving.
He would give $100 million to a candidate for president so long as that presidential candidate would agree to bomb Iran. Now, it's unbelievable to me that we're having multimillionaires and billionaires buying foreign policy for us as well as domestic policy. So the thought, as you think about the election coming up November 6th, we have got to do something more than just say we don't like it. Maybe we need another Bob Fest, another meeting, come together with people all over the country before November 6th to say, we want our democracy back. So give it some thought when we're talking about this afternoon. Now, is Eric?
Hello, Ed.
Eric Schubring, WOJB. And Fighting Bob Blog Talk.
And Fighting Bob, Fighting Bob Radio, mm-hmm. at FightingBob.com. Ed and I and David Giffey talk every week at 11 o'clock, and you can find us on the Internet. Ed and I have been doing a program together on WOJB out of Lac-Couturier near Hayward for 11 years, I think.
Yeah.
Just 1 year short of the founding of the Fighting Bob organization, and I'm pleased and proud as punch to be able to do that. This is my friend Jason Raybuck. Jason and I are going to be playing music
Hello.
This afternoon. You know, I want to give a shout out, and this is one of the reasons, I want you to all join us at Fighting Bob Radio on Thursdays at 11. You can also download, all of the programs are archived. So you can download the programs, and we've had some wonderful guests on the program, and we look forward to more, and we hope you'll join us with that. I especially want to shout out to and acknowledgement of the fact that this afternoon Bill McKibben will be speaking. We're going to sing you a song about Lake Superior that was written back in the day when Lake Superior was actually so damn cold, which is the refrain of this song. It's been warming, as Bill reminded me. I also want to acknowledge the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, and the hard work that they're doing fighting against the mine. We hope you will join them in that struggle against that out-of-state corporation which seems to think that it can come in here and direct Wisconsin's government to do whatever they want and to spoil perhaps one of the finest rivers in the state, the Bad River. It's a good river. And Lake Superior and the wild rice beds of the Kakagan Sloughs. Again, this song was written a long time ago. It's a bit of an historical song that I wrote with a friend of mine, Lou Arsoni, some 30 years ago, as I said, back when the lake was actually so damn cold you'd be wary about going in past your ankles for more than a few minutes. I'm from Wisconsin, that's understood. Never been traveled and work in the woods. Run by your rivers, hunt in your pines. Grandpa was foreman in the iron ore mines. You are the best thing I'll ever see. Superior, you look like an ocean to me. Factory of winds, your collection of gales. Keep me awake in the night with your whales. And you're so damn cold. You're so damn cold. New old Joe Mackey, a trapper by trade. Hands were as hard as the traps that he laid. Muskrat in the mink, beaver sometimes. He followed your hills, he followed his lines. New Russell Olson, his whole life was spent sailing the ore boats and paying the rent. You bruised him and you beat him, he loved you well. Kind to him sometimes, put him through hell. You are the best thing I'll ever see. Superior, you look like
is so damn cold. The French and the English came over the sea, claim you and to tame you and to build companies. Iroquois fought for you, for their land, for their homes. Water turned red and I can still hear their moans. Great Lake Superior, child you are. Your daddy is a glacier and your mama's a star. Been poisoned, mistreated, mined till you're raw. Forest clear cut by that steel cross-cut saw. You are the best thing I'll ever see. Superior, you look like an ocean to me. Your factory of winds, your collection of gales, keep me awake in the night with your wails. And you're so damn cold. You're so damn cold. I'm from Wisconsin. That's understood. I've never been traveled and I work in the woods. Run by your rivers, hunt in your pines. Forest clear cut and you'll hear your mind. You are the best thing I'll ever see. Superior, you look like an ocean to me. Your factory of winds, your collection of gales. Keep me awake in the night with your wails and your soul. You're so damn cold, and you're so damn cold. You're so damn cold, and may you be cold again. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Ed.
It's still pretty damn cold, I can tell you that much. I want to just discuss this afternoon's program just for a minute. At 1 o'clock, we're going to have breakout sessions as soon as we break from here until a little bit after 1 o'clock when Congresswoman Gwen Moore will be here speaking about, I'm sure, the national economy and a few other things such as Tammy Baldwin. Then we have Mike Papantonio for the first time. Mike Papantonio, some of you have seen him on Ring of Fire or heard about him, watched him on television. I think he's one of the brightest lawyers in the country, and he's going to raise a lot of hell as well. Greg Pallas will be here this afternoon, and Phil Donahue and Norman Solomon talking about the body of war as well as the ease in which we can slip into war if we're not careful. Bill McKibben, could there be a better time than now to have Bill McKibben come back to Fighting Bob Fest? So we're really looking forward to hearing him speak this afternoon. So Paul Soglin is the mayor of Madison. Anybody who doesn't know that probably hasn't lived in Wisconsin for several years. So Paul Soglin is here to welcome you to Madison, so please welcome Paul Soglin. You don't have to run.
Well, let me just tell you, I was really torn this morning as to whether or not to show up or appear at 7:45 at the Labor Temple and catch the bus to Chicago. My father was one of the founding members of the Chicago Teachers Union. After the third strike, I showed up at home. I was wandering in through the garage, and I found a wooden placard, Chicago Teachers Union on strike. I went in and I asked him, wasn't that a little heavy to carry around? He says, no, we're going to need it, and I'm sick and tired of wasting cardboard. As it was, he used it another three times over the years. I'll come back to that in a moment, but first I just want to ask you, do you want the usual perfunctory welcome to the city, or would you like a little content? In the next couple of months, the city of Madison is going to get a proposed ordinance. An ordinance for the city council to consider, which is going to require anyone who does business with the city of Madison in the amount of $25,000 a year or more to disclose any campaign contributions they make. To any organization or candidate working on behalf of a candidate or working independently and has found their way to take the monies and slip it in under United. We may not be able to ban them from doing business with the city, but if they are taking our money and they are working against us, we want to know about it. The other thing I want to share with you is just a couple of thoughts about the Democratic Party. In my lifetime, the Democratic Party has made two kinds of mistakes. Well, maybe more, but two that I can think of that's relevant to this discussion. The first is taking positions that are just downright reactionary and wrong. I speak there of the segregationists in the South, those who refuse to recognize Roe v. Wade and the rights of a woman, any person, to control their own body and to have a confidential private relationship with their health care providers. But the second kind of mistake have feared that they needed to embrace a Republican agenda. And that has left a tear within the party which we've seen has lasted for decades. An example of that, obviously, was the war in Vietnam and the mistaken belief that the Democratic Party had to lead the way in a military battle against communism on the southeast mainland of Asia. Another example of that was NAFTA and various trade agreements which have destroyed American manufacturing and unions. And the third one is now among us, and it's embraced by too many progressive Democrats or people who claim to be Democrats, and I'm talking about their efforts to destroy public education in this country. There is a movie that is about to be launched in this nation, brought to you by the people who produced the documentary Waiting for Superman. I have had an opportunity to see it. This film claims that it is based on reality, and it tells the story of a school district and a school in Pittsburgh where teachers and parents unite to overthrow the evil forces of the school administration and the teachers' union. This film is basically produced and orchestrated by Democrats. There's even one individual who is associated with Norma Ray, who is involved with this movie, which is just beyond belief. The premise of the movie is that corrupt administration in schools, along with the teachers' unions, are conspiring to stop education's progress in this nation. Last night, I was watching Bill Maher, and he raised the point in the interview with his guest. He raised the point that what about the community, the neighborhood, the environment in which these children are growing up in our urban communities and some rural communities, where there are parents who are addicted to drugs, where there are 23 shootings in one neighborhood of Lawndale in Chicago. How are teachers expected to overcome these conditions, which I want to point out are the responsibility of the very elected officials in the legislatures and in the city councils, the governors and the mayors who are requiring teacher evaluation. Why aren't they being evaluated by the same standards? We know that homelessness is probably the largest single factor that determines educational outcome. We know that on any given day that the biggest impediment to a child learning has nothing to do with textbooks. It has to do with food. It's called hunger. And yet, these folks cavalierly dismiss these realities and are saying to our teachers, you are responsible for where we, the elected city council members, we, the elected state legislators, have failed. That's nonsense. I hope that the Democratic Party avoids another Vietnam. I hope that we can bring understanding and rational discussion to this debate about public education. And with that, I want to conclude by giving you sage advice that is better than Jim Hightower's. You cannot end a speech without talking about being naked. Jim's comments bring to me the sage, wise advice that I wish to share with you, observed by Mark Twain. Wear clothes. Naked people have little influence on society. Thank you.
How do you know? I misspoke. The lunch and breakout sessions start now, and we come back here at 1 o'clock to hear Congresswoman Gwen Moore. So I'm sorry for the misspokenness. What is it, Bonnie? I just misspoke. I made a mistake. So now that we're leaving here, you're going to grab some lunch, go to your breakout session, and we'll see you back here shortly after 1 o'clock. Thank you.
Palace investigates Karl Rove, the Koch gang, and their buck buddies, as he puts it, including a comic book by Ted Rom. Robert Kennedy called him the last investigative reporter in America. Catherine Harris called him twisted and maniacal. And the White House simply said, we hate that son of a bitch. I give you Greg Palast.
Okay. Yeah, you can stand up if you just want to stretch. But let's get to work. Thank you, Bob Fest folks. Thank you, my governor, Ed Garvey, John Nichols, a giant, my lawyer, Mike Papantonio, who is law partner of my work partner, Bobby Kennedy. And thank you so much to the great team at the Progressive, to Bob Fest, and especially to my mentor here tonight from the Steelworkers Union oil can, Eddie Sadlowski, one more time, please. And I have a special guest for you. A surprise. I didn't tell Ed, I didn't tell no one. But I have here the worst teacher in Chicago, from the city of Chicago, one of our great school teachers, Mary Arendt, please stand up, from the city of Chicago. Today, please, I want you to stand for the teachers of Chicago right now. Our honored guest today. You bet. If you look at GregPalast.com, you see a story called The Worst Teacher in Chicago, made up of four teachers who have the same story. She's the worst teacher in Chicago, according to Romney Emanuel. Thank you. Overpaid because she has that terrible thing
a master's degree, advanced degrees, special training and special education, and in several subjects, and over, and nearly three decades of experience. Right? So she's one of those terrible teachers who then volunteered to work in a school with, close your ears, poor children. And believe it or not, when they were dodging bullets instead of having breakfast, they didn't score too well. So she, her school was closed and she lost her job. She was thrown out, one of those terrible teachers with the low scores. And nearby, they opened the charter school. That would save us. Where you don't have to worry about credentials and experience or anything, and the teachers work dirt cheap. And they were able to hire a hotshot teacher, but at a much lower price. Same woman, Mary. That's how it is. It's not about improving education or educational reform, the way that they talk about reforming Social Security, which means taking it away. It's a class war in the classroom. It's to create chartered schools so that most of the kids will be left in uncharted waters. Have you ever heard of an industry saying, let's not look for the most experienced, most credentialed workers? Let's only hire those without experience, without credentials, because then we can replace them with for-profit schools, with for-profit robots, because they say they want that our future is the children. Yeah, that's true, Mr. Romney, Emmanuel. It's true. The children of China who will make the things we want, the children of India who will program them. And our kids only need to have enough education to stack the boxes from China in the Walmart. One more time for our guest of honor, our honorable guest, Chicago school teacher Mary Arendt. Thank you. I have a question for you, Wisconsin. For you, Paul Ryan? Paul Ryan? Okay. Here's the question, quiz. Who invented Paul Ryan? Who hatched Paul Ryan? Well, I am an investigative reporter for BBC Television, which, as you know, I have to do over there, because over here, investigative journalism is not permitted under Patriot Act 3, except on Democracy Now. Now, who is Paul Ryan? I've been investigating this man. According to the Wall Street Journal, and according to the information I have, Paul Ryan was raised by vultures. This is true. No, come on. This is a fact. It's a fact. It's a biological fact. Okay? And I'm going to explain. See, because I looked I said, where did this guy come from? And the Wall Street Journal said that Mitt Romney picked Mr. Ryan at the request of his number most important donor, Paul Singer. Now, who's Paul Singer? The most important donor to Mitt Romney is Paul Singer, and he picked Ryan. Who is this guy? Paul Singer? That name rings a bell. Oh, because he's not known as Mr. Singer in the banking world and throughout the world. He is known as the Vulture. I didn't give him that name. That's the name his bankers give him. The Vulture. He's the guy that hatched Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney. Now, I've been tracking the Vulture for BBC Television, for The Guardian, and for a show you may have never heard of because it's not on your TV, called Democracy Now!, where I've tracked the Vulture to South America, to the Congo, to Europe, to Detroit, and just came back from the Congo, where the Vulture figured out a wonderful way. He's a multi-billionaire, and one of his billions was simply made by taking money that was meant to end a cholera epidemic in the Congo. This is what I got out of the Congo for BBC.
He took the money to end the cholera epidemic and put it in his pocket through an extraordinary financial flim-flam, which the British government has now declared illegal. The German government has declared illegal throughout, even, by the way, even Paul Wolfowitz, so even the wolves don't like the vultures, has said this is a crime. In the rest of the world, the guy that gave you Mitt Romney, the guy that gave you Paul Ryan, the vulture, is an international outlaw, but for Mitt Romney and in the United States, he's a job creator. Okay? This is where, now, vultures eat, feast when things die. They feast when things die, like the banking system. When Lehman went down, and took my pension with it, by the way, personal. The vulture swooped down and picked up Lehman and has made a killing, literally, from TARP, from the TARP funds. But I will say that one Wisconsin congressman stood up and took a principled position against TARP, Paul Ryan, and then voted for it and got a huge check from the vulture, who is overwhelmingly his number one donor. Okay? Now, maybe you've heard of a corporation that used to be here in Wisconsin called General Motors. They had a place in Janesville, in, I can't remember whose district. GM was on its knees. Was on its knees, and down swooped the vulture and grabbed the auto parts division of General Motors, and he paid 67 cents a share through a wonderful financial flim-flam. He got it, the parts division of General Motors. And then the Obama auto team said, okay, we've got a system to save the plants, to save the auto parts industry, and they lined up the whole deal, and they told the vulture, we're going to give you $1 billion. And he said, no, $1 billion. So he paid 67 cents. He wanted $22. He wanted a 3,200% profit for his money. He wanted $2.5 billion in his pocket. And the auto team said, are you nuts? And he said, well, you're going to have some very funny-looking cars without steering columns. He literally grabbed the industry by the ball bearings. I am quoting you. We will shut you down. It was pure blackmail. We will shut you down. Chrysler said it could run 3 months without the steering columns, and GM said it could run 3 hours. He got his 3,000%. He got his billions from the auto bailout money. And I will say one Wisconsin congressman stood up against this bailout, Paul Ryan, and then voted for it and got a heck of a big check from the vulture and a reward, the vice presidency, the nomination, right? Now, when I say the vice presidency, how can they win it? You do the math. If the 1% votes and the 99% vote, they can't win. The vulture doesn't stand a chance when humans vote, right? So, they can't win it. They have to steal it. Now, how does that happen? The answer is, there's a flower. The answer is turd blossom. Now, it's a flower. It's the nickname that George Bush gave to the guy with the plan to steal the election. Ah, the smell of Karl Rove in the morning. You see, now how's he going to do that? Okay. Well, as they said, today, here, right now, in the next hour, I'm releasing a book from my not-for-profit foundation with cartoons by Ted Rowell. Yes, you are going to have to get this. Yes, you must. It is all the jokes you can make about the end of American democracy. It's called Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, with an introduction and a chapter by Mike's partner, Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. And we tell you about the billionaires and the ballot bandits because I've been tracking these guys for years. People don't steal votes to win elections. They steal votes to get the money. So this is a book that traces from the billionaires, the vulture, the Iceman, the snake. Again, I didn't give them these names. Their grateful bankers did. That's who's here. And how they're going to do it. Now, how are they going to do it? Billionaires and ballot bandits. How to steal an election in 9 easy steps. Let me just give you one. So you have to get the book for the other 8. Let me give you one. And this is where Rove comes in. Data trust. Back in 2000, I discovered that there was a computer program that seemed to target black people and remove them for the voter rolls. And sure enough, I found it. Catherine Harris's purge list of felons, criminals, bad folk who shouldn't vote. And indeed, I now have totaled up those lists to 94,000 names, and they were guilty of voting while black. Like Willie Steen, an African-American Gulf War veteran that I met who took his 5-year-old son to vote with him to learn about how democracy works. And boy, did he get a lesson. The person that said, your daddy can't vote because he's a criminal, he's a felon. They knew that because he was right next to his name on the voter registry. It said BLA. BLA. Black. He's a felon. Turns out he was matched with a guy named Willie Osteen from Ohio, who committed a crime in Ohio and was removed in Florida. Nice little program. How they come up with this. And here's another one. Mrs. Bobby Moore of Florida, lost her vote too. She's another BLA. She lost her vote because Mr. Robert Moore committed a crime. Mr. Robert Moore committed a crime, so Bobby, B-O-B-B-I, lost her vote, Robert Bobby. That's how they did it. And not only that, but Robert committed his crime in 2014. Now, really? Here's the ugly part. That's not from Catherine Harris's 2000 list. That's from the state list today. Today. How many innocent people are on that list? Every name. Because I went to the Attorney General and I said, if you have an illegal voter, would you arrest them? They said, absolutely. I said, so how many from this list of 90,000 names? How many have you arrested? He said, well, none. He said, it's just a list. It's just America. Now, that's purging one of 9 ways. There's tossing and ejecting and prestidigitizing and I can't even remember them all. I have to buy the book and read it myself. So Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, How to Steal an Election in 9 Easy Steps. And Bobby called one of those methods a crime. And that's where Mr. Rove comes in. He says it's a crime. They should be in prison, but they aren't. Mr. Rove has a data system called, a data mining system called Data Trust. Has more information on you than the FBI legally has. And that's combined, and the vulture, has put Data Trust together with a system called Themis, another massive data mining system, which is funded by these guys, I know you heard of them, the Koch brothers. Rove and the Koch brothers together with 2 combined computer systems where their purpose is to target, not to convince you to vote for Romney or Romney Emanuel or whomever. There's no swing voters. It's to make sure that your vote doesn't get counted. 5.9 million votes. We detail how the 5.9 million votes minimum will be stolen. And one of the ways they do it is caging. They use those lists. They send out mail to voters and say, welcome, voter. And it says, do not forward. First class. Very expensive. It takes millions to send out first class letters. And so what happened? Letters came back where it said, do not forward. And the Rove operation used that. They did this already to challenge the right of people to vote. Okay, well, because they said it's a fraudulent address. Well, who are the fraudulent voters? Well, here in Billionaires and Ballot Bandits is a list of fraudulent voters. You notice that this list, every one of them, is at the Naval Air Station in Jacksonville, Florida. Now, Mr. Rove, why wouldn't a soldier be at their home naval base address? They challenged the votes of active duty soldiers sent overseas, especially those that were BLA black. And as law professor Kennedy says in the introduction, that's a crime. And so are the guys, is Rove in jail? No, he's running a $250 million operation called American Crossroads. Is the guy who helped him do it and sent out the list, Tim Griffin, is he in jail? Bobby said he should be in jail. No, he's in Congress. Put there by a $164,000 donation from the Kochs. And by the way, you give $164,000 to a congressman in a congressional race from one source, that congressman will wash your car with their tongue. And that's what he's done. He's the big sponsor, the XL Pipeline. Read it in Billy Dares and Ballot Bandits. You'll find out the Kochs connection there. There was a third guy, Turd Blossom's assistant to his assistant, named Matt Rhodes. He's not in jail either. He is the manager of the Romney for President campaign. Congratulations. Now, how do you stop it? First, you know about it. You have to know how the burglars get into the safe, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. All proceeds, as they said, go to the not-for-profit foundation so that Mike and Bobby and I can, Mike's involved in this too, we're going to be taking these guys on legally, but informationally. But you need something else besides the book. You're going to need this. Seven ways to beat the ballot bandits. I call it, think of it as the way to protect your vote. It's at the back of Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. It's free. If you don't get the book, just go to ballotbandits.org, download it, reprint it, send it on. It has more information, ballotbandits.org. Think of this is how you save at least your own vote, like don't go postal, things like that. 488,000 votes were mailed in last election and tossed out, never counted, because Rove, Data Trust, and the Themis machine will know who you are and figure out that, for example, one of my favorites, tens of thousands of votes trash because they had the wrong size envelope they were mailed in, which were given out by the Republican Secretary of State so that the state deliberately gave people the wrong size envelope and then disqualified the vote. That's how they do it. Don't go postal. This is your ballot condom. So that's what we need. And I'm going to leave you this. Okay. Right? This is our investigation together for the teachers, for the kids. You know, in my investigations of the Vulture, the Iceman, all these guys, I used to be an investigator. Eddie Sadlowski at Steelworkers put me on my first investigation, but one of my others was to investigate the theft of oil from an Indian reservation. Poor Indians with stripper wells make a couple bucks a week in royalties. Trucks are taking away their oil. Osage Indian Reservation. We followed the trucks back. I was with the FBI. Filmed it. There's a white guy, tall guy, standing on a loading dock in Oklahoma telling these people to... His name was Charles Koch. One of his vice presidents was wired. When asked why... Remember, Koch is already a billionaire. He's, you know, got the old, his daddy, he inherited it from his daddy, so he got it the old fascist way. Koch said, when asked why he, a billionaire, why would he steal a few bucks from
Osage Indians living in mobile homes in Oklahoma. And Koch said, and I quote, "I want my fair share, and that's all of it." Well, I think he deserves what's coming to him, too. Too big to fail, not too big to jail. Join the campaign, ballotbandits.org, and thank you so much. This is Fighting Bob Fest, not Snoozing Bob Fest. Bless you. Thank you.
Hi, friends. Matt Rothschild from the Progressive Magazine. It's great to see everybody here. It's a great pleasure of mine to be able to introduce our next speaker, Juan Cole. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan, and he's one of the leading U.S. scholars on the Middle East. Actually, when something happens in the Middle East, as it has over the last week, of course, I always turn to Juan Cole and his informed comment at juancole.com to figure out what's really going on over there, because you can't simply find it out watching ABC or CBS or CNN, and you can't find it out certainly reading the corporate press here in the United States. But he is able to decipher what's going on because he speaks about 10 different languages, and including Arabic and Hebrew and all sorts of languages that I'm jealous about and wish I could speak them as well as he could. On top of that, you know, he may not look like it. You can take a look at him when he comes up here, but he's really a dangerous man. You can ask Bush and Cheney about them, because Bush and Cheney actually sicked the CIA on Juan Cole. Why did they do that? Because he was telling the truth about the Iraq War. And it's dangerous for the powers that be when we tell the truth in this country, sad as that is. You may have seen Juan Cole on Fareed Zakaria's show, or once on the Stephen Colbert show. But now you get to see him in person. I give you Juan Cole.
Well, thanks so much, everyone. I'm so delighted to be here with you in what I refer to as Tahrir Square West, and especially on this weekend when we've had this wonderful court ruling declaring unconstitutional Governor Walker's attack on the public unions. I'm addressing you at a time of great turmoil in American relations with the Middle East, for which none of us should ever apologize. Apparently, if you do something bad, you should just tough it out and never apologize. You know, there was a saying in the early 20th century, which some people have attributed to Ambrose Bierce, but we historians really aren't clear on who came up with it, that said that war is God's way of teaching Americans geography. And that may have been true 100 years ago or 50 years ago. I regret to report to you that it's no longer working. Oh, we're still having the wars, but it's not teaching us geography anymore. And despite the rise of 24-hour so-called news channels and despite an advanced schooling system and great universities, we seem to be sleepwalking through the American empire abroad, not really paying very much attention to it. 2 weeks ago, the United States fired a drone missile in South Yemen. The drone missiles are usually pretty accurate, but this one missed. It killed 14 innocent people. Of course, since there haven't been any trials, we can't be sure about the guilt of any of the ones that the drones kill. And some of them have been American citizens. How many people here knew that we rubbed out 14 ordinary everyday Yemenis 2 weeks ago? Yeah. So the people who know that are here, you see, and the rest of the country probably doesn't. Yesterday, 4,000 angry Yemenis gathered around the U.S. Embassy, in part. This is part of the hysteria and protest against this Islamophobic film, the trailer of which was released in Arabic in July. But I suspect that it's not just rumors of a YouTube trailer that has angered those 4,000 people. I mean, the fact that the United States is more or less fighting a war in their country. It's a war. Congress hasn't declared it. It's classified, so we can't discuss it. We're not supposed to know it exists. The drone strikes are run by often the CIA, so they're classified. So is there a war in Yemen or isn't there? We don't know. And then when 4,000 Yemenis attack our embassy, I don't know. I think that maybe got 5 seconds on our cable news programs yesterday, and that will be the end of it. We won't hear about Yemen today. You know, the United States is a hyperpower. The French came up with this term, hyperpower. I can't say it with the same sneer that they inject into it. But it's a big country. It's 320 million people, and it throws its weight around. It's a $15 trillion economy. And Yemen is this little dinky country off of the Red Sea. And we're applying our might in that country with no legal framework whatsoever. Did anyone ask you, would you like to throw drones on Yemen? We're in a situation where the United States is doing a lot of things that we don't even know about and don't approve of. We've lost control of our foreign policy. As a republic, our founding generation believed that a republic was full of responsible citizens who would make collective decisions. We're in a situation now where even a relatively good guy like Barack Obama is claiming to be assassin-in-chief. You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger could never be president, born in Austria, but we get the Terminator anyway. And apparently there's a process going on here which is beyond parties, although I have to say that, you know, if we have to have an assassin-in-chief, better Obama than some of his rivals. At least I probably don't have to look over my shoulder too much. But we've lost control of this process to where these unconstitutional things are constantly being declared as perfectly normal. We had a law passed in the United States that forbade the U.S. government to assassinate people. And now it's routine to assassinate people. And Eric Holder was approached about that. He says self-defense. One of the people we killed was a 16-year-old boy, the son of Anwar al-Awlaki, who, you know, talked dirty about the United States and was probably a pretty bad guy. But his 16-year-old son hasn't been proven to have done anything, and he's dead, and he was assassinated by a drone.